Address 54, May 27, 1963, Space Dependence of Amplitudes. Lecture 54, May 27, 1963, Space Dependence of Amplitudes. Lecture 54, May 27, 1963, Space Dependence of Amplitudes.
Well, it's the last lecture, and it shouldn't be because I have not run out of stuff. And I would have preferred to have about one or two more beside this one to make better contact between the quantum mechanics, to say if, to take up enough subjects and to round it out right and to make contact with the way you learn it later. So this particular lecture will have is squashed a lot of things and a few things into it so that the edges are not going to be investigated very far. And I will go rather rapidly in a straight line. But I won't stop off to discuss some side points as much as usual. The first thing I want to talk about is the n-state system, just to remind you of how it works, because as far as I know, except for writing it in a summary once in one lecture, I never got around to saying something, and I just want to say it so you're sure it's true. If a system has capital, and that's a hell of a... If a system has script n states, which we represent by I, then any state phi can be represented as a linear combination of it, and these coefficients, a linear combination of the i's, and these coefficients we call ci. And then the equation for the behavior as a function of time of the ci's is given in this way with a set of coefficients hij. That you know, that's the same. It's only n, okay? Now here's what I think I forgot to say. We talked about the problem solving. The problem when H is a constant, I only solve the two-state system when H is a constant. I'd now like very rapidly to point out it isn't at all difficult. You probably have noticed it yourself. What happens when there are n states and the energy is constant? If the H's are all constant, then this has a solution of the mathematical form of a set of constants times all the C's varying at the same frequency, namely times e to the minus I over H et. And if you substitute this in here, then the derivatives of the E produces EAI. On the other side, we have the sum over all J of HIJ, AJ. This is a set of any linear equations for n unknowns, but they're homogeneous equations. And they only have solutions on, if you're lucky, if the determinant of the coefficients of all the A's is zero, is the mathematical statement of it. But you don't have to be so clever. You can just try to solve the equations and find that you can only solve them for certain values of E. However, if you want to, you can put the E's on the other side in the form delta IJ AJ times E and get this equation. And then you may or may not know, and if you don't know, it's too bad, you're learning now, that a set of linear equations with coefficients like this, which all add up to zero, then the determinant of the whole array of coefficients has to be zero. That is to say that the following determinant is zero. That determinant with elements equal to the H's, H1, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 3, and so on, everywhere except that E is subtracted from every diagonal element that comes from the EAI term. Then the equation that the determinant equals zero is an algebraic equation in the E because the determinant is found by taking products of elements all around different ways. And the best you can do is when you're going down a diagonal, you get E to the script n power, and so it's a polynomial in e to the nth of the nth order, and therefore has n roots. So there, in general, are n roots. Some of the roots may be equal. We'll leave the mathematical case of equal roots as one of the possibilities, of course. They have n roots, but we still write them as n different numbers. Maybe e1 equals e2 numerically, but I still like to write it this way. And for each one of these roots, I've taken a typical letter, capital N, to represent one of the 1, 2, 3, 4, N. The number EN here has a, when you put E equals EN, then you can solve the equation, and the set of coefficients to which that, of that solution, I'll call A sub I with an N upstairs. That doesn't mean to the nth. It means the nth one, let's say. Then, of course, we can make new states by taking certain linear combinations of the old ones with the coefficients a, i, n, and these new states, n, are states which have a definite energy. in the sense, as you can prove no doubt, that H operating on such a state will produce a number times that state, the number in fact being E sub n. These states n can be all chosen to be orthogonal. As a matter of fact, it turns out that that's automatically true if En is not equal to Em. In other words, if the numerical values of the energy of different states are different, then automatically the two states are orthogonal. Mn is equal to zero. I can be normalized, so I can make it delta Mn. And finally, if it happens accidentally that En equals Em, then you can find two solutions which are orthogonal, and so it's always convenient to choose them so. And therefore, you can, the set of states of the definite energies of a given operator H can be used for a basis. Now, I just wanted to say all that because it's easy to remember. It's a simple idea. One thing, for fun, I'd like to prove that if the two energies are different, then the states are indeed orthogonal. Since Hn is equal to Enn, and in the same way, of course, by taking the other way about, we know that for any state, we can also put it backwards. We would have this times a number. Then let's consider a calculation of the following quantity. What will we get? Well, we can think of H times En being H times the state N being En and get this from the first equation. Or if we use the second equation by running it against the other way, we would have Em times Mn, and those two are equal. But if En and Em are unequal, the only way the two can be equal is they're both zero. So the two states are orthogonal if En and Em are different numerically. If they happen to be equal numerically, you can always choose the solutions orthogonal, and that's that. Okay, high speed, eh? But it's, I don't think, much from what we already spoke about. It's just to remark to state that the states can be taken orthogonal, and they come out orthogonal. And that is n instead of 2. Now I'd like to do a problem which is interesting in its own right and which I would like to have done a little bit longer and discussed the solution more carefully and done some more cases and so on. But I'll just do one because it's a very pretty little problem. We have the two-pit system, I would call it. For instance, the ammonia molecule where a thing can sit in either 1 or 2 position and then leak from 2 to 1 or from 1 to 2. Now I'm going to try to begin the analysis, a three-dimensional crystal, but I'm only going to take one dimension. You see, the rest of the lecture would have been to go to three dimensions and so on, and that's what I mean by not being able to develop the subject far enough. But take a one-dimensional crystal, which consists of an infinite line, or if you went a very long line, I'm not going to pay attention to the details at the end points. That's another one of those things that I would say more about if I had more time. So we say it's infinitely long. And that an electron can sit, an extra electron is put in a crystal. For instance, a piece of germanium, and we have an extra electron in the germanium supplied by some impurity or just stuck in or some other way. And then this electron might sit here. On the other hand, it might sit here or here or here or here and so on. And the base states that we will represent the thing might be considered to be state n, that it sits on the nth atom. For shortcut purposes, to make this lecture continuous, I'm going to replace the definition of this by saying xn. I'm going to locate the atoms at locations xn so that the difference between the two of them is b. Then b is the spacing between them. And instead of saying on atom n, symbol this way, I'll say it's on the atom at xn. Well, I can write my base states any way I want, so I'm going to write, it's just a symbol, it's just identical, that it's on the position xn. So that the base states of this system is this, an electron at atom number n, which is located at the position xn, will be written as this base state here. And those are the various base states of the system. And now I'm going to suppose that each of the atoms, if the electron is in one atom, that there's a certain amplitude that it leaks to the neighbor on either side. And we'll take the simplest case, that it can only leak directly to the nearest neighbor. To get to the next nearest neighbor, it's got to do it in two steps. You can do the case where it has a certain leakage rate to the nearest neighbor and a different one to the next nearest neighbor. but it's all similar, very similar. And I'll suppose that it has an amplitude minus A to leak per second and so forth. And anyway, that's the matrix that goes into the Hamiltonian to leak from one to the next. Any state phi of the electron, of course, is the amplitude, has an amplitude to be at all the different places. And that is, any state phi can be given by giving a coefficient which tells with what amplitude it's located on atom Xn, at Xn. That's a superposition in the same way of the base states. It's an example of this case. But instead of writing C sub n, I'd write C at Xn. It's just the amplitude to be found at Xn. It's just a slight difference in notation because I want to make a transition to space later in the lecture. Then the equations which I propose for the character of the Hamiltonian is to propose that the original equations are the following, that IH, that's the rate of change of the amplitude to be at atom n, is the following. First, some coefficient that depends upon the energy to be at n, if it couldn't leak, sort of, which is some constant or other, times Cxn. It doesn't make any difference what this constant is. It's a zero point of energy. Now, the more interesting is the physical phenomena, which is that if it's at Xn plus B, if it's at the next atom over, it has a certain amplitude to leak into atom N. And if it's at the atom on the other side, it has an amplitude to leak in. Incidentally, Xn plus B is the same as Xn plus 1 and so on, you see. Now, this is a set of equations with constant Hamiltonian. I'm trying to find the energy levels of it, so I try a solution of the form that all the different amplitudes vary with the same frequency. I should have said that the C's depend upon T, the A's do not. Substituting that, being then the same equation, you just place A by C and that IH dot by E. We've seen that before. And so we have this equation. Now you say, okay, I take the determinant. Don't. The determinants you can only take with as a 2 or 3 or 4. If you have N in the thing, blah, 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 you might as well go quit. Oh, it's true that the mathematicians can evaluate that determinant, but the way that they evaluate the determinant is by solving the original equations, which we're going to do. So we're going to try to solve the equation directly. Here's an equation which tells us x at one point in terms of x at nearby points. It's a kind of difference equation. We're used to equations of this kind of differential equations in which it tells evaluate x in terms of infinitesimally nearby points, and for differential equations, a linear equations with constant coefficients have solutions of the form of a wave, e to the ikxn, exponentials, I mean, exponentials. And it turns out that linear difference equations also have exponentials as their solution. And so we try this solution. We'll just try it. I happen to know it's right. We try it. We put it in here. We get e times e to the ikxn. We get here e naught times the same thing. We get here a times e to the ikxn plus b, and so forth by direct substitution. Now, e to the ikxn cancels out of every term. That shows it's a solution. And all I have left is that e equals e naught minus a e to the ikb minus a e to the minus ikb. E to the ikb plus e to the minus ikb is twice the cosine of kb. And therefore, I have the energy E is equal to E naught minus 2a cosine kb. Done. We have a number of different possible energies, one corresponding to each value of k. And each value of k corresponds to a different solution. The amplitude to find the thing at different atoms varies oscillatorily in space. That depends on k. With k very small, it varies slowly, and k very large, it varies rapidly from one atom to the next. And the energy as a function of k looks like this. The zero of energy isn't very interesting, and I plotted here the energy from this formula, making the zero, zero for k equals zero. That means that E naught is chosen to be 2a. And you find set of solutions, it goes as cosine. You say, my goodness, we have other values and so on. Now, it's interesting that the k values don't go forever. Suppose that I were to use the value k equals 2 pi over b for first k equals 0. Then the amplitude to be at every atom would be equal. The lowest state of the system has equal amplitude to find the electron everywhere. Now, let's look at k equal 2 pi over b. If you put k equal 2 pi over b in here, Since every xn is an integral multiple of b, then this is just e to the 2 pi times an integer, which is 1 again. So it's the same solution again. It's not a new solution. That is, this expression here is the same, exactly the same mathematically when k is increased by 2 pi over b. It doesn't represent another solution. It isn't anything new. It's the same solution. So that k's outside of a certain range, and I'm going to choose the range from minus pi b to pi b, k's outside of that range are not new solutions, don't represent anything else but the same solution over again. The physical reason for that is that if I would suppose that the wave would go like this, then I haven't said anything. I said the amplitude to be on every atom is the same, and that's the same as having flat. So too sharp a k with finite atoms is no new solution. Anyway, that's the way the thing behaves. If we take the case in which the k is small compared to the spacing between the atoms, the situation is especially interesting. So let's look down here for small k. That is what we might like to call long waves or slow variations from place to place of the amplitude, the energy being particularly low as it can nearly get. Then the cosine is 1 plus the square of the thing inside minus the square times 2 is plus times a half is, well, you know, times b squared times k squared. I am not interested in the zero of the energy, so I'm going to measure from the bottom. And I change my zero of energy and measure from the lowest state for k equals 0. Now we find that we have in this system particles whose energy is proportional to the square of the wave number or amplitude as it varies from place to place. What did I do wrong? Nothing. That k is small, that the wavelength, in other words, is big compared to the spacing between the atoms, and that I've chosen the zero of energy. I've just shifted the zero so that the zero of energy is at the lowest possible state. So we have then an amplitude which varies like this when the atoms are spaced like this. And this is the energy. And the more rapidly the thing varies, the higher the energy. And those are the various energy states. Now there's something interesting about it. Because if we have not a definite energy, we might ask how the things depend upon time. Suppose that we have a system which is not in a definite energy. Remember, at this level now, the atoms are very fine. You can't see that k is small, so it's a good approximation. Then we have this state. We also might have superposed another energy state with a slightly different wave number. Then they will both be there, and the amplitude will oscillate at different frequencies from the two different e's. And the amplitude then will vary with space because the interference between is which will produce beats. Then the beats will move, and it's like waves with a dispersion. That is to say, if I interpret h omega as this as a frequency, then we know that the waves will move with a certain group velocity equal to the derivative of omega with respect to k, which is equal to 2ab squared k. In other words, they drift the particles. The electron can move through the crystal with a speed proportional to the k. In other words, if you know the electron is somewhere around here, a lot of atoms finely placed, then and happens to have a k nearly equal to a definite value, in other words, the amplitude looks like this, then this thing, this bump where the electron is will move through the crystal at the speed proportional to k. It's easy to see, therefore, that the energy is proportional to the square of the velocity, because k is proportional to velocity. And therefore, in the classical limit, if we were to look at this thing, it would appear like a particle inside this material which has an energy which is proportional to the square of the velocity. That's the kinetic energy of a particle. So it behaves very much like an object, just an object in classical physics, if we look at it on a large scale, that can move around and has an energy proportional to the square of the velocity, usually the coefficient of the coefficient of the velocity squared over 2 is called the effective mass. And by following this around, you can find out what it is. In fact, if you wrote this in the particular form k squared h squared over twice m sub effective, then you'd find that when you checked it out, that this behaves like a particle of mass m in the sense that its energy is proportional to m effective times velocity squared over 2. That hk is equal to m effective times the velocity of the group, and that the kinetic energy is equal to m effective times the velocity of the group squared over 2, and this you could call the momentum. M effective here is equal to, as you can see from the equation, 1 over 2ab squared. There's an h squared somewhere, h squared, for this problem. Don't forget this electron's mass, effective mass, has nothing to do with its real mass. It may be quite different. Actually, in many circumstances of the same general order of magnitude, maybe 2 times, maybe 20 times, but it's not necessarily the same as the electron's ordinary mass in empty space because the atoms are affecting it. We have now explained the remarkable paradox that an electron in a crystal, like an extra electron put into germanium, can ride right through the crystal and flow perfectly freely, even though it has to hit all the atoms. It does so by going pip, 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 pip in amplitude and working its way through the crystal. If the system is irregular, if there are impurities, if you want to, you can solve impurity problem by going all over again and trying to solve it when one of the atoms has a different energy, but it's stuck on one of the atoms with a different energy. You work all the impurity theory out and so forth, make one atom different. Under those circumstances, what happens is that the electrons, the waves are altered, and in a sense, the thing collides and bounces back from, is reflected, the waves are reflected from this impurity. And it is the impurities only and the irregularities of the lattice which make some resistance to this perfectly, otherwise perfectly free-moving particle. The so-called the semiconductors, germanium and silicon, work this way, that at a finite temperature, there are very small numbers of electrons excited up by thermal excitation, and they ride around in the system like this. And we put electric fields on them, pull them forwards and backwards. It's just like having electrons in a vacuum. And so it acts something like a radio tube, and for this very similar reasons. You see, I could hope to develop the physics of, I can now give a long lecture on transistors, but there's no time. Now, we would like next to consider what happens if the piece of metal is long but finite. And I would just remark that we should do something careful about the end conditions, because these equations are right except for the ones at the end. But I won't go into the details except to say that you can get the right answer by imagining that you only get the solutions that we have over here, which are zero, one atom beyond the true end at each end. But within an atom, there's zero at each end. Now, the lowest possible solution, therefore, if this is a piece of metal of finite, of length L, is to have the sine wave have a pair of sine. You see, the only solutions are these curves. And the only way to get it zero at both ends is to add two of them, one going this way and one going that way with the wavelength just right. You've done this before with waves in a string. And so the k value here is two values. There's a positive 1, pi over L, and a negative 1, pi over L, both superposed in here. But of course, the magnitude of k is the same. And the energy in this approximation here, it corresponds then to h squared over 2m times pi over L squared. And this is the lowest energy of the system, the first excited state, let's the first state, say, for electrons, say E1. I don't want to call it E0 because I call this E0. That is, the really lowest state isn't zero because the k isn't quite zero, but it's a little bit higher. Or if you want, of course, the next solution is to put the double wave in here. And that's the same as the other problem for half as big an L. And that means 4 times the energy. I only have to work it out. 2 pi over L is the K value. And the next level is 4 times the E1. And likewise, the next level, which corresponds to 3 waves, is 9 times E1 and so on. And so we have a series of energies which are separate as one unit, and then there's 4 and 9, and they go as the squares of integers. So an electron confined in a box like this will have a series of energy levels, and those are like the energy levels of an atom. An atom is like an electron, only it's confined in a very small box. This is an electron confined in a metal. The spacing 1, 4, 9 is not right for an atom because there are complicated forces and it's more difficult. But this is the simplest problem of a one-dimensional box. And that's the origin of energy levels in more complicated systems. Now I want to go away from these problems and to enter a new business, which is the behavior of amplitudes in the space. We have here, of course, something like an amplitude in space, but not exactly. Although we've written it as C of xn, the amplitude to find the electron at xn, it isn't strictly the amplitude to find it right at the atom. It just means the amplitude to find it in the vicinity of this atom in whatever condition it is. And the other one is the amplitude to find the vicinity, the next atom, and so on. And the amplitude to find it in between is not something that means anything in this approximation. However, we can understand real space, in a way, if we want, by imagining or hoping to imagine that it is very much like having a situation in which the atoms are so very, very, very finely spaced, if you wish, that we can practically specify the amplitude anywhere. And so we generalize the idea of quantum mechanical amplitude, of being at a place of... We generalize the idea of having states with a finite number of possibilities for base states to the idea that the number is uncountable. It's a continuum. That is, we do the following when we deal with space. First of all, I'm going to forget about take an electron, but forget about the fact that it has spin 1/2 completely, and also forget that space has 3 dimensions, so let's take just 1 dimension. Then we could specify a new idea, which is the amplitude that the electron is located at the position x. This is the amplitude to find the electron. No, that's not the amplitude. That's the state. That represents an electron at x. That's a state corresponding to electron at x. If phi is the true state of the electron, which is varying, has a certain amplitude to be everywhere, this can be represented as a superposition. It may be at x, and it may be at other places, each with an amplitude given this way, summed over all possible x. And this quantity, then, could be understood as the amplitude to find the electron at x. And, of course, x phi squared would equal the probability to find it at x. Now, immediately, unless you're so busy writing that you can't think, you've thought of something that's obviously nutty. You can't sum over x. If x is a continuous variable, there's only one modification that has to be made of all our formulas. For all our formulas, such as chi phi is equal to the sum over I of chi I phi, when the I is a continuous variable like x, then we have to invent a little improvement in the notation that sum shall mean something else, and the answer is that we will use integral dx instead of sum. That makes slight differences in definitions, because it depends on what unit of length you use, how these things are defined, and so on, so the integrals will make sense. Furthermore, in this problem here, we know there's no such a thing as to find the object exactly at x. We have to find it in a certain range. And so this quantity, dx times this, is the probability to find it at x in range dx. That's the only complication so that this disappears and is replaced by an integral sign dx. That's the only difference, but that's the only extra feature that makes space instead of continuous. We have a continuous variable instead of a discontinuous variable. I give some example quickly Another example is, we also mentioned the possibility of specifying a momentum P. We could also have another, I shouldn't say, definite momentum P. That could be a certain state. That could be, for example, a state phi. Now, for example, let's look at this. What is this? This is the amplitude to find a particle at x if it's known to have a definite momentum P. We've discussed this many times. We had a special lecture on particles with a definite momentum. And we know that the amplitude to find it at different places when it has a momentum P is a wave. It's the Broglie's wave. And so we already know this connection. For example, as one example of one of these amplitude things between, in fact, two continuous variables. Just for your, those who are mathematically inclined, may I say that with the case of the momentum variable, there are various conventions of how to do the sum. What I have found is the best is to say it's not the integral dp, but the integral of dp over 2 pi h. The reason for that is that that's 1 here then. That's all. That's just a little trick. I always use for the momentum integration summings 2 dp over 2 pi h, and for the positions just dx. But that's a small bit. We're not going to do momentum anyway. We're not going to do any calculations. There's unfortunately no more time. Now, we next have to discuss questions like what the wave equation might, what the rate of change of amplitudes might be with time. And that's the next thing I'll talk about. Suppose that I have a certain state, let's say psi, which is changing in time. Then the amplitude to be found in the state x is enough to determine the state psi. This is the basis x, just like it was here. It's exactly the same except for psi. If I know all these coefficients, they are the analogs of the ci, so we could call them cx. I should call them cx because I've been using ci all the time. In fact, I will call them cx, although that's not what they usually happen to be called. People usually don't use c for this thing. They use the same letter, C of X, which is rather confusing. They use the same letter for the state as for the function. But let's do that. Let's use CX for a while. In the end, you can change it to C of X. Now then, the equation of, that we would have gotten over there is that, well, we know the following, that if the state is changing with time, that H on the state, that there's an H. And the next problem is to discover how these things, if the state of changing with time, they also then depend on time, how these things depend on time, then that's going to be some kind of a thing analogous to HIJCJ. And the best thing to do is to tell you what it really is. That is, it's sometimes written as H times C of X and T in a sense, but that's a little different notation than we've been using. However, it is equal to the following, as I'll explain in a minute. Let's find out what it has to equal. We don't know what it has to equal. We never can create the Hamiltonian from nothing, but we can make it kind of reasonable by showing some properties it ought to satisfy. First of all, we know that there's no potentials anywhere, and it's just a free particle, that if the particle is a plane wave, that the energy of that plane wave is p squared over 2m, where now I mean by m the real mass of the electron. So we know that this should be a solution of this equation. This special thing should be a solution of the equation for a plane wave, if this is e, when this differential is equivalent to e. It should be p squared over 2m. In other words, what the question is, what must I do to this on here, on this side, to produce p squared over 2m times it? And the answer is this. If you differentiate with respect to x twice, you get p squared over h squared times it. And if you multiply by h squared, you get p squared times it. And then divide by 2m, you get p squared over 2m times it. In other words, this thing here is equal to p squared over 2m times e to the I px minus. Now, this is a side remark. This is certainly true, or minus, actually. That's true. And this is the energy times the state. And if it were a plane wave with the energy factors in, which I forgot to put in, then we would know that this particular state satisfies this equation. That's not T, that's X. That is, the particular plane wave satisfies it, but any solution, it must be a linear equation, because we would like also that linear combinations of plane waves satisfy it, and there's little escape from this being the formula for the amplitude, because it has all the right properties. A plane wave is a solution of definite energy. The energy of the wave goes as p squared over 2m, where p is the coefficient in the wave. And finally, it, since it's linear, it permits any superposition, so that's the right solution. So the formula for H for a single particle of mass m, non-relativistically, is 1 over 2m times the second derivative with respect to x times the function c, if there's no potential present. Let us look at that relative to our little bumping amplitude business. You see that this difference, if I would add 2a times cn of x, is like the second derivative in the limit as b goes to 0. If the if there's a certain chance per second that the amplitude makes its way to the neighborhood on each side, or better, if the amplitude here is fed from each side, then the amount that it picks up depends upon the second derivative of the amplitude, except for a constant, which is always a zero of energy. It depends on the second derivative of the amplitude with respect to x. This equation, therefore, represents a kind of diffusion of amplitude, that an electron here has in a certain moment a certain amplitude to leak, if you will, although it's a free particle, to neighboring points, and that's what this said. In this problem here with the atoms, we got the same kind of a solution for the physical reasons that are the same. And if we had a new problem, which there was also a potential present, so that the energy on each atom would be different, then this would be varying from atom to atom, this E naught. So if we come over here and we want to do a problem when there's a potential present, we would have to have also the variation of the potential, which also may depend upon the time, for at each place. This is the energy a particle has if it's located at x, whether it moves or not. And this is the contribution due to the fact that it diffuses, so to speak, from point to point. And that's the formula, this one here, without the middle line equation. This thing here is the equation in one dimension for a particle and a potential. The equation in three dimensions is easily extended and is given in this equation down here, in which I change c to psi, so it would be more conventional. And then the second derivative becomes a Laplacian, and the potential is a function of vector position and time. And that's called the Schrödinger equation for a single non-relativistic particle in no magnetic field. Now you have to read books after this, and you can learn all about it. Now you can read books, because all the books start there. But before we do that, I would like to say where they end up. At page 700 in the book, it finally lets on to two things. In the first place, it doesn't do to have only one amplitude for an electron. You have to give the amplitude to be at x in the up spin state. The base states are x in the up spin state and x in the down spin state. And so you have two functions, psi plus to be up spin, which is the amplitude to be in this state, and psi minus the amplitude to be in the other state. And you can generalize this formula. I'll generalize it right now. If this is plus plus, then you must have another term, because when you sum over the base states, you must sum over all possible kind of spin, that means plus and minus, and all possible positions, that means x. And so that's the generalization of this. When there's both spin, a half, and position. That's one change, that there are two functions. Second, next change is that the Hamiltonian can no longer be guessed by rules which is sometimes given in the earlier part of the game, as soon as you have spin. So you have to know the Hamiltonian from guesswork, experience, and so on, but not from the arguments that you start from classical physics and just do something definite to classical physics to get this Hamiltonian. You cannot. Classical physics, of course, is the physics of classical particles depends on the Hamiltonian. So in the laws of classical physics, there's an image of this, a shadow. But from the shadow, you cannot create the object with all its color. You can get some idea of its outline. And then the earliest part of the book, they make a big emphasis about how you can get this from the classical physics by some rules. But the rules don't all work. That is, you forgot the ears. You can't see them. The guy's showing you a silhouette from the profile. So the ears of spin don't come out from such. That's the first shock. The second important point to be made is this, that if you start here and work too long with this in the books, you get the idea that there's a wave in space associated with the electron. This wave, we know, is only the amplitude to find an electron at a point. And there's not like a real wave in space. You say, oh, it's just a pedantic difference. It's much worse than a pedantic difference because, let me say what happens when you have two electrons, one and two, moving about. Then you'll have to give the space states are that the first electron is at x1, the second one is at x2, never mind the spin. So these are the base states. And the amplitudes then are a function of x1 and x2 and time. So that the amplitudes to find electron is this. There's an amplitude to find this one here and that one there at each time, and this one here and that one there, and so on. And these, of course, are vector positions, so it's a function in six dimensions. The waves no longer exist in the real three-dimensional space in the same sense, and they cannot be represented that way, or you get into those paradoxes which you don't seem to be able to appreciate now. Having like we'd had in the case of the two photons, nobody seemed to be worried about it, fortunately, because they didn't get the idea that there was a single wave function for one photon. Now, the right thing to do is now is to go on and to solve a number of problems for different kinds of potentials, hydrogen atoms and so on, to find out how the amplitude depends upon position in space. And of course, we're not going to do that. You can find that in all kinds of books. And you're going to, if you want, can learn that from other people. Now, however, I do want to say that we do know a lot about how the amplitude will vary with position in space, with angle in space. And I would like to discuss that matter a little bit. So I return then to certain applications of the idea that there's an amplitude in space, and to point out that we already know something about how the amplitude varies in space. So we take a problem. We have some object, and I use the same objects that I used before, a neon 20 in some excited state of angular momentum J, which incidentally is an integer, or it won't work, it can't, these have only integer spins. It goes into oxygen 16 and an alpha particle, and both of these have spin zero. Now, suppose for a moment that we found the alpha particle in this direction and the oxygen in this direction. Well, the problem I want to solve is the following. Here's a neon 20, and this is z-axis. And it happens to be in a very special state of angular momentum J with the z component of angular momentum M. It's in this state. The question is, when it disintegrates, with what amplitude will I find an alpha particle going off here at an angle theta and, to be complete, also back in here phi, you know, in the spherical geometry with the angle phi. I want to know with what amplitude do I find an alpha particle coming this way and the oxygen 16 going that way. I solve that problem by the following observation. That if the alpha particle went in this direction, exactly up, and the oxygen exactly down, since both of these carry spin zero, the angular momentum about this axis is zero. Therefore, in this case, the only state from which it can possibly have come is the state J naught. It must have come from J naught. Therefore, the answer to the question with what amplitude it comes out at the angle theta, all I need to know, or what I need to know, is the amplitude that JM, when seen at an angle theta and phi, is in this axis, in the state J naught, in the prime system. That's the answer. If this was called, if the amplitude for this process is called A, then the amplitude for this process will be A multiplied by the amplitude that, in fact, I am in the state J naught after I rotate around the y-axis an angle theta and the z-axis an angle phi, the original state JM. So the answer is that the thing does depend upon angle by this horrible thing. This, incidentally, has many names. Never mind. To give an example, however, we'll just take the case of J equals 1. Then with if M is plus 1, we have to go from plus 1, 1 to 0, 1. And we have, that's our usual naught, the plus 1 business, which is 1 over the square root of 2 of sine theta. Or if it starts in M equals 0, then it's cosine theta. And if it starts in minus 1, it's 1 over the square root of 2 of sine theta. So for the three values of F, for the case J equals 1, the angular distribution varies in this way. Wait. Also, if you want to be careful, it also varies with phi. And because of the rotations around phi, when the z's are these different values, you get e to the I phi, e to the nothing, and e to the minus I phi. So here are three angular distributions, three possibilities depending upon the original state of the neon. In short, we have determined the fact that the alpha particle will appear in different directions with an angular distribution given by special important functions. These are the important functions. We have, these things happen so often and are so important, they have names. If it's one of the, if the angular distribution is one of these three functions, or a linear combination thereof, we say the system has orbital angular momentum 1. That's clear. And we also say, unfortunately, instead of being so specific, it's a p-wave alpha particle. So we have to have a dictionary that tells us what those letters are that tell the different angular momentum. You see, here's the dictionary. If the orbital angular momentum is 0, then there's no change when you rotate coordinate systems, and the variation in angle is 1. That is, it doesn't depend on angle. This is called an S state. If there is only one such state. If the orbital angular momentum is 1, then the angular variation may be one of these three or linear combinations, depending upon the value of m. And this is called a p state, and there are three of them. And so on it goes. If the orbital angular momentum is 2, then there's the central function 2 naught, which is called p sub 2 of cosine, it's got a lot of different names. And there are five functions altogether. That's called a D wave, and there are 5 solutions. Now, you can immediately guess what the next letter is. S, P, D, well, F, G, H, and so on. The letters don't mean anything. They did once mean something, of course. They meant sharp lines, diffuse principal lines, diffuse lines, and fundamental lines of the spectrum. But those were in days when they didn't know what they corresponded to. Incidentally, if you want, you'll notice that if you take a reflection, an inversion, these things all change sign. This doesn't, and the odd ones do, and the even ones don't. I take another column. Incidentally, the general formula for it is, I use L instead of J because it's conventional to use L for J when it's orbital angular momentum. It's this thing we just worked out. It also has other definitions. These are all, I said identical, they're equal within constants, which I can't remember, numerical coefficients involving L and M. Sometimes called YLM of theta and phi, if you look in one book. Another book will find it written as P sub L superscript M cosine theta e to the IM phi. It does depend on e to the IM phi, you see. The special case M equals zero, without, you just leave this out, it's called Picabel of cosine theta, a function which I believe you've studied. Now, one more thing. That's an alpha particle coming out of a disintegration. What about an electron in a hydrogen atom? Or in any field in which the potential is a central potential. Let's suppose that the potential depends only on radial distance, so that the physics is unchanged under rotation about the center. Otherwise, you can't make arguments about angular momentum. And also, let's forget about the spin completely, and say that we have a system of angular momentum L. That's orbital angular momentum, because we should really add the spin, but we leave it out. You can do more complicated with the spin. We suppose that the spin is not affecting the orbital motion at all. Then, we ask ourselves this question. If the system is in a state Lm, with what amplitude do we find the electron here at angle theta and phi inside at a certain radius r? Method of solution. Take the special case that we want to find it on the z-axis at a distance r. What state must it be here? If this is the nucleus, which we have no spin, nothing has any spin except the motion in this problem. We just take a simple problem. Then the angular momentum about the vertical axis must be zero. If I find the particle here, then any angular momentum it had, even classically if it's moving, would have to be at right angles. There's none along the axis if it's coming right at me and has zero, or right here and has zero spin. So the angular momentum around the vertical axis is zero, and this can only happen if it's in the state LO. So by the same kind of argument precisely as made before, and this maybe happens with some amplitude which is a function of R that's unknown. Now, picking the same R out here, the same problem exists, only I have to refer it to the other axis and I get LO, and I get exactly the same problem as I solved over here, and exactly the same functions and the same thing. So that these functions are also the amplitude for finding the electron as a function of angle inside the hydrogen atom. They are of some interest. In an S state, if we say if the electron is in an S state, that means this, that the angular momentum, that then it's independent of angle. The amplitude to find it at different places depends only on the radius. If it's in a P state, it depends on angle in many possible ways. Let's take the case cosine theta. That's interesting. That means that it's positive, say, in the upper part and negative in the lower part, and when theta is 90 degrees, it's zero, so that the probability of finding a particle is not spherically symmetrical, a square is not spherically symmetrical, it's strong at top and bottom. It's for this reason that electrons in states like this show attractions for other molecules and atoms which are oriented with direction. And there's the origin of the directed valences of chemical attraction. In a very sloppy approximation, which is called the central field approximation, you can get a rough idea of the periodic table. If we forget about all the other electrons and think that all the others, in some sense, average their effects out to only produce a centrally averaged potential, a spherically symmetrical potential, it's a very poor approximation, but the qualitative results are right, then we can think of each electron having possible states, either S, P, D, and so on. And for each of these states, they can either be spinning up or down. So that there are two S states. There are six P states. There are 10 D states. And there are 14 F states and so on. Now, as we put the electrons into the atom, you know that only each electron can only occupy one state. So when we put in one, we get the hydrogen atom, 1S, then the helium, 2. The next electron must go to a higher state. It turns out in this particular problem that the next higher state is also an S state. But it's not so strongly bound. It's easy to get off. So after we pass helium and come to lithium in the periodic table, the third element, we can remove the electron easily. And so forth. Its next is filling an S state, and then it fills a P state. So it takes 8 more before it's completed another proximate, simple, closed system and has to go to a new S state. And that comes at neon, 8 away from helium. And these various numbers appear in the periodic table. If you do the same thing for objects of angular momentum a half, as we did for zero here, including the spin for nucleons, because the spin and orbit is closely connected with nucleon, you can find other numbers by doing the same thing with one-halves in here, and you find the numbers of the shell model of nuclei as well as the periodic table of the atoms. I'm sure that you've studied the periodic table and its relation to orbits, so I'm not going into that in any further detail. One thing I did forget to say, please excuse me, and I just have to come back absolutely with a jump, and that is that when I was talking about continuous states, I forgot one thing, and that is that the state to be in position y and to be in position x is orthogonal, and you would like to write that dyx, but in continuous variables, that isn't it, and Dirac had to invent a symbol to represent that. He wrote dy minus x, and I understand that you've heard about the delta function in the mathematics class, so that's what that is. Well, I've been talking to you for 2 years, and now I'm going to quit, and I would like to in some ways apologize, in other ways not. I hope that I know that 2 or 3 dozen of you have been able to follow everything with great excitement and have a good time with it. It has been said that the powers of instruction are of very little efficacy, except in those happy circumstances in which they are practically useless. And so for the 2 or 3 dozen who have understood everything, may I say I have done nothing but shown you these things. For the others, if I have made you hate the subject, I'm sorry. You remember that I also hated Shakespeare when I went to high school, but I found it was beautiful anyway. I hope that someone else can teach it to you in a way that doesn't give you indigestion, like my way. I never taught an elementary subjects before, and so I apologize, but I just hope that I haven't caused a serious trouble to you, and that you do not leave this exciting business, and that you find someday that, after all, it isn't so horrible as it looks. And finally, may I say that the main purpose of my teaching is not to prepare you for some examination which you have a pretty good idea of what it's going to be like ahead of time, but the purpose of teaching is to give you some appreciation of the, well, it's not even to prepare you to serve industry and the military, although that is what but it's mostly to give you some appreciation of the wonderful world and to get some real culture of what I believe is the true part of a true culture of modern times. The English professors would find it somewhat exaggerated, but I think that they're completely wrong. And that to give you some appreciation of this culture, and so that you may appreciate and even possibly join in the greatest adventure that the human mind has ever gone on to. Thank you very much. Is the space in between the atoms. The atoms.
For each K, it's another sort of state, possibility.
Right.
So the thing might try to get in all of them. I mean,
any of them. Or a linear combination.
What if you integrated over K?
What for?
Well, it looks to me like that's what you have to do. This thing is following the pattern of trying to get in all the possible. Each K is a
definite energy level.
Energy level.
Right.
Now all K's are possible.
Right.
So
there's many different possible states it could be in. could be moving this way, could be moving that way, could be doing nothing. The lowest of all possible states, which it would be, for instance, if it were cold, and the crystal were very cold, it would try to get to the lowest possible state, it would be K equals zero, definite state. Then if you put electric fields on it and so on, you can move it into other states and excite it to higher states and lower states, but there's a whole continuum of state. In fact, there's a band of energies. I forgot to call it that. This is an energy band. That's what they call an energy band. Yeah, any energy from here to here. It's called bands and solids. You see, electron can have any one of a band of energy. In an atom, yeah, band theory is the theory of this equation, only with three dimensions and more complicated.
Yes, questions like what moves this electron along?
What moves it?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on whether you have any external forces or anything. I mean, how does it get from one atom to the next?
Yeah.
Well, I just made something like the ammonia molecule, or like a hydrogen molecular ion. An electron confined here always has some amplitude to jump over to the neighbor. It may be very small. For instance, the electrons that are right near the bottom in the K shell have a great deal of difficulty in getting out and going to the other K shell. And so the K shell band is very narrow. A is very small.
What I mean is, do you ask what forces or what actually moves this thing?
Well, nothing moves. It has a certain amplitude to get to another place.
Didn't you necessarily go?
Well, I mean, if it does go, and after a while it has a certain energy and...
This is the same as any problem that we did before. For instance, we could ask, although it turns out that it's quite a job to solve, but let me give you a specific problem. Suppose at T equals zero, the electron is located, we know, at one particular atom. All right? What will happen as a function of time? Here's how we solve that. Okay, an electron in a particular atom is one of these special states, which must be represented as a linear combination of all of these states. And so we have a whole lot of different K values. There's an example when you have to have many K values. Because any one K value gives an amplitude to be in lots of states. In order to get to be in one state, it has to have a whole lot of different K values together. It's just an exaggeration of the case when there were two states. In the case of the ammonia molecule, two energy levels, and to be in one side required a linear combination of those two. So to be in one atom requires a linear combination of these states for lots of values of K. Now each one of them with different values of K vary with frequency in a different way. Well, after a little while, you have the same superposition of states except that all the phases are changed. When you put them together, you get a complicated curve which gives the amplitude to find the atom electron in many places. It'll turn out that to find it very far away is very small. It'll be somewhere in the neighborhood in a complicated function. And then as time goes on, it spreads. But we don't have to have a mechanism to push it from one. Because those are the bottom mechanisms of quantum mechanics, the amplitude to go from one place to another.
You just don't consider the question at all.
No, you have to do it the other way. When something is being pushed, what does that mean? When it's being pushed, it means I have a different energy here than here. So if you let E naught vary from atom to atom, which I didn't do, and solve a problem where the E naught is varying, and then start with something over here, you'll find it moves. It's pulled by the potential, you see. Yeah, but what happens is it really means it sort of means it sort of flips back and forth, and then all the interferences work to move it over. And you say, well, what then pushed it? Well, pushing is something we invented afterwards to describe that. Yeah.
Dr. Fowler, a physics club a few weeks ago, was talking about some genius thing in galaxies of star affinity, solar masses. I was talking to Dr. Einstein about it later, and he said, not everybody's convinced of this, quote, that Bitcoin doesn't believe it. Unquote. I was wondering why.
Well, let me quote myself correctly. If there's a star of mass 10, if you put it together in a matter of mass 10 to the 8, in a big glob and it start to fall together.
Yeah.
Then, as it begins to collapse, the theory of gravitation hasn't any solution. We don't, I mean, because the closer it comes together, the heavier it is, I mean, the greater the forces on the inside, and the pressures developed by the matter on the inside are not sufficient to hold it up. And you can show that there's no, we don't know the solution to the problem. So presumably there'd be some kind of terrible collapse with unknown, but involving the theory of, general theory of relativity. That is quite possible. The thing I say I don't agree with is that neutrino phenomena and the inside is what Fowler originally said was the cause of the collapse. Well, by neutrinos, yes, that's what he says. That's irrelevant. The thing I tried to say is that if his star is as big as it is, he doesn't realize it, but the effects of gravity already would make it a calamity with an unknown solution at the moment. And so before you worry about the neutrinos, you should worry about the gravity. I don't mean that the idea is wrong. It's not an important point. It collapses and explodes or something. But it's not due to neutrinos, I would guess. That's my opinion. Whether that's the origin of the explosions and so on, I don't know. But it isn't the neutrinos, because that bigger star would collapse gravitationally. And that's a problem we don't know the answer to. What happens if you have too much matter and it falls together? The equations have no understandable solutions. Nobody's worked them out.
I have one question, Dick. You called for an insert B, C separate sheet. There was no separate sheet.
No.
I found one separate sheet, which was on that thing you told me about in that chapter.
I must have left it home by mistake.
Then there was another one where I found no separate sheet.
It was right in the chapter there.
No.
Oh, Christ, it must have fallen out. The reason I say, oh, Christ, is I'm not going home. I'm going to New York.
Oh.
I can drive home. I guess I'll drive home.
I'd recognize it if I saw it. I know what it's about.
It's on white paper the same way.
Yeah, but I mean, I also know what it should be saying. Is it in a place where
it's on my desk.
It's
on my desk.
Maybe
it must have just fallen out.
You're sure it isn't in your office?
I'll look.
Yeah, I'll look.
But wherever it is, it fell out. Wherever it is, it fell out.